If it's Wednesday, it's the day to hear from our chief political writer, Seth Richardson, on the Cleveland Mayor's race. One of the things we'll talk about today on This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I once again want to thank everybody who listens. Every day we're setting a new record for downloads over the last 30 days. Set another one yesterday. Welcome, Seth. Welcome, Laura. Welcome, Jane. Hope you're all happy midweek with another really humid day in North Carolina.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, glad to be here.
I'm so sick of sweating. Bring on the icy winter. I'm ready. All right, let's get going. What are the facts behind an Ohio school district that had to close down because of student illness just 1 week after bringing students back to their classrooms? Laura Johnston, this could be an omen for what's ahead in Northeast Ohio, or maybe not, but it certainly is a chilling
Absolutely.
Story.
This is the first district we've heard of in Ohio, but students were back in Fairfield for less than a week when the school shut down because of a more than 300% increase in kids out sick. This is insane. So about 14.5% of the students at Fairfield local schools in Highland County were sick on Monday morning. That doesn't include all the kids who are placed into quarantine. So the percentage of kids out could be higher. And the superintendent said it's not just COVID, it's colds and RSV. But I mean, come on. So this is happening all over the country, especially in small rural districts. We're just not quite seeing it here in Northeast Ohio yet.
Well, the RSV is interesting. I think that's what I had in May when I got deathly ill. And it's a bear of a virus. Kids who are getting it are really getting knocked out. It's a bronchial thing, and it causes wheezing and lots of coughing. And it's apparently as contagious as the variant. And so we're hearing from parents that their kids are really sick with that, too. When kids go into the emergency room, they're apparently being tested all at once for COVID, RSV, and the flu, because it could be any of the three. But yeah, I mean, look, the schools are in a tough spot. If a kid comes in and it turns out that kid has COVID, anybody that was in the orbit of that kid stays home and they're not getting any instruction, right, Laura? I mean, this isn't like right. Last year where you had online instruction. It's basically you're sitting home watching television and playing video games while your parents look for some kind of childcare.
Yeah, option. I mean, this is a quarantine that could be for 2 weeks. There's no instruction. So you figure they're sending books and assignments home, but there's not like you can log on to a remote classroom or watch from home over your computer. And you have to think the teachers are like, oh no, like how bad is this going to be if I have half my class out? They're going to spend half the year catching everybody up. Nobody wants that. And the way to get around that for having quarantine is to wear a mask to school. And that's what all the superintendents keep pointing to. They say, you know, there's a lot of schools that have not put in a mask mandate, but they quote, highly recommend masks. Parma, for example. And they're telling people, if you don't want your kids to have to quarantine, have them wear the masks, because then even if they're exposed, they won't have to quarantine. But this is something we're going to keep seeing play out over and over again. We just saw Willoughby and Eastlake today put in a mask mandate. They didn't have one before because they've seen the number of cases rising already in a week. I think they started August 18th. So you have to wonder if that's going to happen in other districts as well.
No, I don't think it's an if. I think it's going to happen. I think we're going to see a cascading number of kids getting sick. You mentioned the idea that they're going to spend the whole year catching kids up who've been out. This year was supposed to be the catch-up year from what happened during last year when kids mostly worked from home, and when they came back, it was deep into the year. So if you're trying to get kids up to speed from all the losses from last year and there's suddenly big absences and people staying home, You're not going to do it. So this is a generation
kind
that's
of
in
ironic
trouble.
Because I think the reasoning for the no masking started happening in June when they're like, okay, the numbers are going down. We're going to have a normal school year, right? We're going to be back at it. It's going to be great. And then this Delta variant comes along, completely changes the outlook for COVID, but school districts didn't necessarily rethink all of their plans. So, I mean, some districts did, obviously, but this idea of it being a normal year, it's not a normal year. And we can't expect that right now. I mean, kids still, most districts, I don't think they're letting volunteers in. They're not going on field trips. So we're going to see how it goes. I mean, I think Bay Village has every 2 weeks, they're going to check in about a mandate. My district said first quarter. But yeah, it's at least I think we're being a little more careful than you see in places like Georgia or Florida or Arizona. I guess there's more than 80 districts across the country that have already closed or delayed in-person classes because of this. In Florida, they're not even allowed for schools to put in mask mandates. And teachers or parents are fighting the other way. Just please let our kids have a mask mandate.
Okay, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. How fast are coronavirus cases and hospitalizations rising in Ohio? And how do the numbers compare to this time last summer? Jane Calhoun, I would have never imagined we'd be ahead of where we were last summer. We're way ahead of where we were.
Yeah, I guess I'm back to being the bad news bearer on this podcast. But I'll tell you, if you look at this chart that Rich Exner put together with our story, showing the increases from like June to now versus the same time period last year, it's really sobering. I mean, the line for this year, probably starting in mid to late July, it's going almost straight up, whereas last year it was on this sort of downward angle. So I have all the horrible numbers for you. We reached a 6-month high of 4,117 cases on Tuesday. And this just shows no sign of leveling. The 7-day average of cases per day tripled from 1,095 a day at the end of July to 3,296 on Tuesday. At the same point last year, on August 24th, the average was 941 cases a day. We also have hospitalizations going up. There were 2,095 coronavirus patients in a preliminary count for Tuesday, and that was the first time it was over 2,000 since February 8th. And among those more than 2,000 patients, 610 were in intensive care. And so the number of ICU patients is rising too, you know, almost like in tandem with the hospitalizations. And that after it had dipped to only 50 on July 11th. You know, on July 6th, there were only about 200 hospitalized patients, which was the low point for this summer. But as
you know,
said,
if you think about what you said, that we're going back to February 9th, that was before the huge majority of people were vaccinated. Elderly people were getting vaccinated in January. But to be back above the number back then, before we really got the vaccinations going, is frightening. And we're seeing there are hospitals that are running out of beds. There's just no beds for the people coming in. So we're back in the rage. And one of the things Rich seemed to say was there's no sign that this is going to abate.
No. Although, you know, we are nowhere near the more than 5,000 like hospitalizations we had in mid-December. But is that good news? No, it's not really good news. I mean, that there was, I should say, one element of positive news from Tuesday. And that's that we achieved the milestone of 60% of Ohioans age 12 and up, or 6 million residents, had received their at least one dose of the COVID vaccine.
And you think that's good news? I'm looking at 40% of these people who are not vaccinated.
Yeah, I know.
What's wrong with you?
I mean, it's in line nationally at 61%, I guess. And it's a mixed bag. Like Pennsylvania is at 68%, Indiana is at 49%, Michigan 54%. So, you know, we're ahead of some and behind others. It's not where we need to be.
Can I add something? This is Laura Johnston.
Go ahead, Laura.
The difference, you talk about February, obviously it's when most of us were not vaccinated. But on top of that, there were things in place to slow this. We still had, you know, social distancing requirements. We still had a mask mandate. And I feel like we look at these numbers and they're skyrocketing and we have no plans to address them. Like, people shrug and say, you should get vaccinated, but there's so many people that don't, and there's so many people that don't want masks, and there's no plan for how to bring these numbers down.
Yeah, that's a good point. The one thing that we can do now that we couldn't do then is you can get N95 masks to get the highest level of protection possible. So there's that. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What did we learn from the first day of the trial of Ken Mills, the former head of the Cuyahoga County Jail, who was accused of lying to the county council and negligently running the jail? Laura Johnston, this one kind of baffles me. It doesn't seem like what we're about to talk about serves the interests of
justice. I feel like you're going to be throwing a flag, Chris. But Attorney General Dave Yost's office offered two separate plea deals to Ken Mills as he awaited trial. One plea offer would have allowed him to plead guilty to a third-degree felony, a charge of tampering with records, and he would have been eligible for probation and go without jail time. Obviously, the judge would have had to agree with that. But there was also a deal where he could plead guilty to one of four misdemeanor charges. And in exchange, he would have had to serve, quote, a brief period of incarceration.
Yeah, that's the thing I don't get. If you're the prosecutor and you are trying to effect justice, why wouldn't you look at it and say, what's fair here for him to plead guilty to, given all the facts, what are we willing to do? But to play this game where you're trying to get a notch on your bedpost for the felony conviction by saying, hey, look, plead to the felony because that'll make me look good and you don't have to go to jail, or, you know, plead to the misdemeanor, but then you're going to have to go to jail. That just seems like sleazy to me.
Yeah, I don't understand it. Usually, obviously, the greater the offense, the higher the punishment. And I mean, Wills rejected both of them because his lawyer says he didn't do it. But that must have been a tough decision to look at those and say, OK, this could end, you know, and I could not have to go to prison, because who knows what's going to end up at this trial. As we talked about yesterday, like, this is going to be a deep dive into county dysfunction.
Yeah, and which is a little bit unfair. Look, everything about this investigation has been pretty stinky. We've talked about it from the beginning. And I do feel bad for Armin Budish, because he's going to walk into court today and he's going to have a choice. He's either going to testify, which they will then use and twist to try and build the criminal case that they're building against him, or he's going to take the fifth and look like he's hiding something. He's really in a no-win situation for an investigation that was pretty much bogus.
I'm going to write that down, that you said today that you feel sorry, you feel bad for Armin Budish.
Well, but it's not fair, right? I mean, we know that the investigation into him was never for real. He hasn't committed a crime. He's just incompetent. Right. That's not a crime. And they don't have him. They've been investigating him now for what, 2.5 years, and they haven't gotten anything, but it's still open. So that puts him in this horrible place where he's coming in to testify in this case, knowing that anything he says, and these guys have not always operated in good faith, will be twisted and used against him somehow. It's really an untenable situation, because if he takes the fifth, you know, he'll be crucified. It's like, whoa, what are you hiding? Even though it is every person's right not to incriminate themselves or offer incriminating information. And he's got a former U.S. attorney for his lawyer who I bet is saying, look, you got to be really careful here. You know, he's trying to make
and
sure
he
this
could
comes out.
He
so
could
we'll
end
see.
Up testifying today. Openings are going to happen today. They seated a jury yesterday. There's 7 men and 5 women. 3 of the jury members are Black. So that concluded yesterday. Today we're going to have the openings, and who knows who we're going to have at testimony.
All right. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How does Cleveland Public Power figure into the race for Cleveland Mayor? Seth Richardson, you did a big story on this today. It is a significant issue. How much is it being talked about, and what did you write about?
It's being talked about in some circles, but not as much as I nearly thought it would have, which, you know, I think is one of the reasons that, you know, we asked all the candidates on the special episodes of This Week in the CLE, you know, about Cleveland Public Power and what they plan to do on it. And, you know, what I wanted to do in the story today was really kind of go over what, you know, what have been the shortcomings of Cleveland Public Power. I think most customers probably have had to deal with their lights going off at some point or another, but also kind of talking about just, you know, power in general, right? Because you've got First Energy, you know, and the Illuminating Company kind of playing a part in this, and some of the actors as well. How much it's going to matter, I honestly don't know. I know that there is at least a decent contingency of people who do care about this. And I think kind of at a base level, people are going to, you know, care about it somewhat, just because, you know, can you keep the lights on is a pretty basic, you know, sort of ask of a politician. I don't think it's ever going to, you know, reach the importance of crime to voters, but I do think it will play a factor.
Well, and what you don't know, it's a long time till November. Even though the primary will be over in less than a month, whether there'll be more revelations that come out of the First Energy deal in Columbus and all the court papers that bring another viewpoint into it. Let me ask you something else about the mayor's race. You know, Frank Jackson won 4 times by talking to 50 people at a time. He'd go to church basements. He was all over town. And what he was able to convincingly do is have people believe that he cared about them, that he was there for them and people trusted him. If he would have run again, I imagine he would have made it through the primary, and who knows what would have happened in a general. But that's the way he won four times. And it's kind of the way Mike White won back in his day. I don't get the feeling that that's happening a lot with this one. There's a lot of candidates in this, and it seems like they're going to a lot of little forums where, you know, the cute quips get them some attention. But is there anybody you see that is trying to do what Frank Jackson did, which is talk to the voters of Cleveland? Forget the people in the suburbs and all the nonsense they have to say. They don't vote. Talk to the people of Cleveland and make them believe that they are the chief priority for the candidate.
I think there's some, maybe some attempts to do that, but when you do have such a crowded field, it becomes very hard. You know, with Jackson, it was, yeah, you know, there might've been crowded primaries from time to time, but it was always kind of a binary choice, right? Where it's Jackson or somebody else. And that is, you know, you don't have that this time. I think this race is incredibly hard to predict out. It's kind of a fruitless effort at this point, just because there are, you know, there's seven candidates in the race, and I think six candidates that really can kind of stake a claim to being, you know, legitimate contenders. So I don't think you're seeing as much of the, hey, I'm going to go talk to, you know, 10, 15, 20 people at a time, because they do need a wider, they need to get known by a wider audience, right? That's why you're seeing all of these forums. And I think part of the thing is, as well, is all of these organizations, you know, when Frank Jackson was running, it wasn't a guarantee that he was going to show up to these forums or anything like that. When you have, you know, all these interest organizations, now they can say, well, three of your opponents are showing up. Are you going to show up? So everybody goes to them. And it's kind of it's campaign via that way now, because all of these, you know, organizations do hold a little more power than they might have in the past, because a forum where you're preaching to, you know, 20, 30, 40 people, maybe it doesn't matter as much in a one-on-one, but when it's a, you know, 6-7 man race, then that's where it becomes important to really log every single vote that you can, especially in what is looking like is going to be a pretty low turnout affair.
But one of the things Jackson did by connecting with people, and look, the public at large didn't see it because, you know, the bulk of Northeast Ohio is not living in the city of Cleveland, but he got people to go out to vote for him by making the connections, by having those conversations in smaller groups. And they really did. Even if they disagreed with things he's done, they believe Frank Jackson was looking out for them. And the model's there. I mean, it worked four times. It probably would have worked the fifth time. And yet none of these politicians seem to get that. And I'm surprised. I get it. I hear what you're saying. If three of the candidates are showing up for a forum and I don't show up, that'll be used against me. So I got to get dragged off to all these things. But these are not really that informative a forum. It's ask a question about an issue, get the talking points, and then maybe one candidate gets a good shot at another and everybody laughs. And it's whoever got the biggest laugh of the night. That's not a connection. That's not the kind of thing that people are going to say, wow, I feel strongly about that person. I'm going to the polls. And I'm just wondering why none of these candidates seems to understand what the appeal was of Frank Jackson.
That I honestly can't answer, but I do think, as far as like the temperament and kind of campaigning that way goes, no, I don't think that is in this race. And, you know, maybe part of that is because they are kind of trying to separate themselves at least a little bit from Frank Jackson, you know, even though, you know, Jackson has endorsed Kevin Kelly in this race. I think what they are sort of trying to do is, you know, the city's going through a rough time right now, right? And I think everybody is trying to make the case that they are the, you know, the stern, steadfast leader. It's not necessarily about, you know, the good feelings, the warm feelings or things like that, and making connections. And I think coronavirus also maybe is playing a part in this, because one of the things is, you know, you might be missing more of those kind of face-to-face interactions, which is really where you build that sort of bond with voters.
Because people are afraid of the coronavirus,
yeah,
that's
so,
a good point.
So you're not having as many of these, you know, basement meetings, or, you know, even if you do, maybe instead of it being 50 people, it's only 10 or 15 people this time. So you're right. Some of that face-to-face interaction. So you kind of do have to do stuff, you know, and it's not like they're not knocking doors and they're not doing campaign events or anything like that. It's just that, I think that some of the, you know, the voter, there is some of that mentality of, okay, well, this virus is still going on, especially with the spike we're seeing right now. That you really want to be seen as the candidate who's having, you know, these kind of in-person events
that,
and whatnot?
That's a good point. The one thing you said that I think is completely 100% true, not that other things you said weren't true, is there's no way of predicting this. And I don't think any poll will predict it accurately, because nobody can poll who actually shows up to vote. I mean, this, whoever gets just a handful of voters to the polls could win. I mean, it's almost like they got to go back to the 60s where they're handing out small bottles of brandy to get people to go to the polls.
Right.
Because this is what it's about, is getting people to the polls. So fascinating. We have a few more weeks before we see who emerges in the primary. Thanks, Seth Richardson. I think that's it for you on the podcast today. I appreciate it. We'll look to you again for next Wednesday. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Have the Cleveland Clinic and University Hospitals come so far from their notorious days of feuding that they are now teaching their tactics for peace to hospitals in other cities? Laura Johnston, this is mind-numbingly shocking for anybody who's been around for a long time. UH and the clinic used to claw each other's eyes out, stealing doctors from each other and really competing. But the two heads now are working together.
Yeah, they learned so much during the pandemic that they wrote a 34-page white paper about collaboration. So UH CEO Dr. Glyph Majerian and clinic CEO President Dr. Tomislav Mihaljevic will discuss this white paper during a forum tomorrow, Thursday, at the City Club. And they believe that they can balance their healthy competition, and they are still competitors, but with joint efforts that could benefit Northeast Ohio, not just for COVID, but for all sorts of things that affect the city of Cleveland: infant mortality, lead paint, and a long-term working relationship.
Well, and the thing that really surprised me is, because this happened quickly, is they are traveling the country talking to hospitals. How did everybody learn so quickly that they had made peace and done some things together? It hasn't been that long in the works. The new head of UH just took over.
Right.
This year.
I mean, all I can think is, you know, the Cleveland Clinic has a really big national profile. And so they probably, I mean, when they talk, people listen. But they, I mean, they've collaborated in the past. It's been like Ebola plans, the RNC, and they're on these local efforts like the Cleveland Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. So, I mean, there's been small steps before, but during COVID, they really ramped it up. They were among the people that recommended Ohio adopt the zones of the hospitals into three zones. They worked together to set up the drive-through COVID testing site, one at UH, one at the clinic, and they actually shared resources, including staff who tested at both sites. And I don't think I knew that they shared data, like they scrubbed it of any identifying information, and then they were able to pinpoint places on the verge of an outbreak, like an apartment building or a nursing home, and send someone there to do testing, encourage everyone to wear a face mask. So they were really being proactive here, which, good for them.
Well, the show they've taken on the road, they're going to be doing at the City Club, and I think it's next week. And we should point out that the MetroHealth CEO Akram Boutros has also been collaborating with them. And let's plug the story. Cameron Fields has put together a story about the changing leadership in all sorts of areas of Cleveland, including the hospitals. These two new leaders of UH and the Cleveland Clinic are a breath of fresh air in the way they're getting along. Look for Cameron's story at the end of the week. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's the latest bad news for Sam Randazzo, Mike DeWine's former utilities chief, who First Energy admitted bribing with $4.3 million? Jane Cahoon, we say this all the time, another day of bad news for Mr. Randazzo.
Yes, it was. The bad news for him is that his lawyer failed to persuade a judge to reverse the judge's earlier order, freezing $8 million worth of Randazzo's assets. This is the case brought by Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost as a result of the House Bill 6 scandal. Randazzo was added to this lawsuit recently on the basis of this bribe you mentioned, the $4.3 million that First Energy admitted paying him in exchange for favorable treatment while Randazzo chaired the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, which, as you said, a position that Governor Mike DeWine appointed him to in early 2019. He hasn't been charged with anything at this point and denies wrongdoing, but Randazzo is implicated in court documents, you know, about this bribe. But anyway, Yost went after his assets because he said Randazzo was trying to move them around so he wouldn't have to surrender them if he was found financially accountable for any type of misconduct. And Yost filed some court papers that said since February, Randazzo had sold 4 properties in Ohio and Florida worth a total of $4.8 million, transferred a $500,000 home in Columbus to his son, and tried to move like $3 million from his brokerage account to a couple of law firms. So anyway, Yost wants Randazzo to give back this $4.3 million as well as his salary that he collected during his nearly 2 years as PUCO chief. So this case has really gotten heated in recent days with Yost's office and Randazzo's lawyer, Roger Sugarman, exchanging some pretty sharp words in the legal briefs they've filed. Sugarman said Brown's orders, Chris Brown, the judge, weren't valid because they were issued before Randazzo was added as a defendant in this case, and he's denied due process. It's unjust, unreasonable, and Yost's office says they're hot air, and all that.
They're fighting an uphill battle here. Yeah. He looks terrible. It looks like he tried to hide his assets. Yost saw it. Yost is locking him down. I'm not surprised by the way this is going. They can throw all the angry words they want. Randazzo's in a heap of trouble. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Was Tuesday wacko day for testimony at the State House? How many people testified in favor of a bill that has no chance of passing, but would pretty much prohibit anyone in the state from requiring any kind of vaccinations for anything? Jane Cahoon, it was wacko day.
Yeah, I did watch most of this hearing, and I didn't keep count, but there definitely was a parade of witnesses, both for and against this bill, over the course of this nearly 5-hour hearing before the Ohio House Health Committee. There was also an anti-vaccine protest outside the State House with people touting this bill. And according to the Columbus Dispatch, members of the Proud Boys were there at that protest. But that's another issue. According to the two Democrats on this committee, there was a big problem with this hearing. The Democrats, Allison Russo and Beth Liston, Russo happens to have a master's in public health, and Liston is a physician. They were concerned that this hearing basically put these conspiracy theorists on equal footing with the medical experts and the members of the business community who came in to oppose this bill and talk about how dangerous it was. So I kind of got a kick out of both of them doing their best to like raise questions about testimony. For instance, when they had a chance to question the witnesses, they pointed out that the people in favor of the bill, some of them were affiliated with groups that had maybe legitimate sounding names, but they believe things like HIV is not linked to AIDS and Barack Obama was using hypnosis on voters. These are the kinds of groups that they were affiliated with.
It's ridiculous that they would have a hearing and have that kind of testimony. It just shows the state of affairs in the State House, where you have legislators inviting pretty much lunatics to come and pretend to be august. It's just what Facebook is doing. It's just misinformation that some segment of the population will believe and then repeat and cause more and more people to not get vaccinated. There's the bill has no chance of passing. It's clear.
At least in its current form. I don't know if they will amend it in some form and pass it. I just don't know that. But
that's what the danger is, because yesterday, OSU, following up on the full approval of the Pfizer vaccine, said, okay, everybody coming in has to get vaccinated or you're not coming in till November, right? So if this bill were to pass, parents that want to send their kids to a college where they know everybody's vaccinated, so they're not sending them into a place where they can get sick and die, wouldn't have that ability anymore, because the legislature would stop responsible organizations like OSU and hospitals and others from acquiring the vaccine. And it's not just
coronavirus vaccine. It's any vaccine.
Anything. Measles vaccines and chickenpox vaccines. It's like we have made life so much safer for children in this country with vaccines. And we have this fringe group of legislators trying to stamp that out and let everybody get sick and die.
Yeah, I mean, a lot lot of these people, they sounded very sincere in their beliefs. There's no doubt in my mind they believe what they're saying, but they're coming in there and saying things like, oh, you know, my mother had a heart attack several days after getting the vaccine. Well, that's not like cause and effect,
no,
you know?
It's flat earthers, man. Just they because had they believe it earnestly doesn't mean you should take it seriously. You know, mental institutions are filled with people who believe fervently in what they're saying. This is crazy. We're supposed to follow science. Yesterday was a really crazy day.
They actually had I'm sorry to keep going here, but a Catholic priest in there who was saying he didn't want to have anything to do with Pope Francis because Pope Francis was encouraging vaccines. And it was so weird. It was so weird.
Okay, we'll leave it there. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Thanks, Jane. Thanks, Laura. Thanks to the departed Seth. And thank you to everybody who listens to this podcast.